Welcome to episode 8 of the Teach and Retire Rich podcast. Today, Scott and I interview retired teacher Steve Shulo, who almost single-handedly started the 403B reform movement. We welcome Steve now. Steve, how you doing?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Steve, according to Facebook, it's your birthday. Is this true?
That's true, yeah. I'm 68 years old.
Oh, well, happy birthday, my friend. We're thrilled to have you. Scott,
thank
are you there?
Thank you very much.
I'm there. Hey, Dan, how you doing? Hey, Steve.
Hi, happy good. Birthday. Thank you.
2 years till required minimum distributions, my friend.
And also, I'm holding out for Social Security. I'll get an extra $100 a month in 2 years rather than at 66. You know, I'm affected by the offset and all that, those restrictions and things like that. So,
did you delay till 70? Or
yeah, I'm delaying till 70.
Good for you.
Smart man. Well, we should get into those topics as well. Before we start, Scott, do you remember when you first met Steve?
Yeah, actually. Well, so just like you and I, Dan, I met Steve online. And it was actually through Dan Otter and his website, 403bwise.com. The discussion board, as we've said many times in the podcast before, the discussion board is really the heart of 403B Wise. It's where everybody comes together as a community and helps people. And one of the very early, we'll say community organizers there, was Steve Shulo. And so when I was researching the 403B for my wife and for some of her colleagues and wondering what the heck this thing was, I came across 403B Wise and all the great articles, but the discussion board is where everything happened, and Steve was and still is very active on the discussion board, and that's kind of how we originally met online.
Steve is a huge asset, not just for 403B Wise, but the greater country, I would say, Steve. So I've tried to think how I first met you, Steve, and obviously it was also online. I think we joked in the earlier podcast about how there was no Google when 403B Wise started. There was something called Alta Vista, and I think I did an Alta Vista search of you, and you had written a paper mentioning the 403B. And I believe, Steve, that's the first time that I had heard your name. And were you running a message board or this is 2000? Did you what kind of online presence did you have then?
I did have a website that I started in 1999, and it got a lot of hits because it was mentioned in the LA Times. The LA Times interviewed me a couple of times about the 403B, and I don't remember what it was. It was the website wasn't all that good, but it was a start, and there was a little bit of a discussion board in there. But you took it to the next level. It was like, you know, 6 months later, you launched your website. And so why have mine? I can tag
well,
on
I'll tell
yours.
You, Steve, you were a huge part of it. I don't know if you remember this. I reached out to you, and you were very kind and gracious, and you included it in your community. And I remember somebody said, oh, that's just Fidelity. Because, you know, 403B, the term 403B was bought by Fidelity Investments.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you just type in 403B, it will say Fidelity. And you had written, you had typed, no, that's not Fidelity. This is guy's a teacher in California. And I just actually just typed in 403B again, and it does say Fidelity. You know what's funny? If you search 403B Wise, but don't go to the website and just see what the Google results are, guess what the first paid ad is above 403B Wise?
I have no idea. Fidelity?
AXA.
I know, you know, during the 2002 when Sacramento had that bill and opposition bought up 403B.net, 403B.org. And what was that? I don't want to mention their name.
Yeah, exactly. So historic. I think Scott and I mentioned that in an earlier podcast, how we were trying to change legislation in California, right, and the opposition bought 403bwise.org and I think .net. So imitation, sincerest form of flattery, I don't know. The other thing I did, which was pretty funny right before I came on, is I searched Steve Shulo, and then I looked at the images results. Scott, I don't know if you've ever done this. Steve is standing next to a Tesla. Steve is standing next to a small plane. Steve is lounging on a golf course. I mean, this guy has really got life figured out.
Wow, he can retire rich.
Absolutely. Actually, Scott, your picture shows up, as does Brian Graff's, the TSA guy. I thought that was pretty funny.
That doesn't surprise me. We had quite a feud going on.
All right, let's get to...
Yeah, Scotty and Brian, I think, have a relationship. It's not a nice one, but...
It is a relationship.
Scott, do you want to say who Brian Graff is, just so listeners know?
Not really. No.
Okay. Yeah. All right, we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, right.
And that's a topic for another show.
Okay, listeners can search Brian Graff, G-R-A-F-F, plus Scott Downhauer. All right, so let's get to the beers. Scott, do you got a beer today?
I do have a beer.
What do you got, my friend?
So this one hails from the great state of Oregon, where I came from. I just got back from vacationing in Oregon and Montana. And by the way, Montana has some amazing microbrews as well. So I actually regret not having the Montana one with me. This one's from the Deschutes Brewery. You can actually get Deschutes beer at quite a few different locations. It's the Inversion IPA, and it's one of my favorite breweries there out in Oregon.
I've actually visited that brewery when we were in Bend 2 years ago, and that is a very good choice. Okay, I have another themed beer here. My beer is another New Mexico beer. It's called Outlaw Lager by Rio Grande Brewing Company. And when I think of Steve Shulo, he is a 403B outlaw to me. So I'm going to go ahead and drink Outlaw Lager to celebrate having Steve Shulo on our podcast. Let me open this up. Cheers, Scott. Cheers, Steve. Steve, did you bring a beer?
Cheers.
I got some water here.
Steve, okay, that's why he's retiring rich.
You mean you want? I should have brought out my Bud Light then.
Scott, this
I'm
is
real
we're
sophisticated.
Still working, and he's being pictured in front of airplanes, golf courses, and Teslas. Anyway, cheers, my friends.
Thank you. Toast.
All right, Steve, let's jump right into this. Tell us, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town in northern Wisconsin called Cumberland. It's about 90 miles northeast of Minneapolis, St. Paul. I was raised on a farm, a family farm, 140 acres. I have one sister and two brothers. I was the youngest. I was a surprise. And I'm a baby boomer, born in 47. I went to a one-room country school. Yeah, where there were 12 kids, grades first grade through fifth grade. They didn't have kindergarten. That was in town, and back in those days, my folks couldn't take me into town. So I never went to kindergarten. And so I was raised on the farm, finished high school, and then I went to college the nearest state college called River Falls for a year. And I didn't know what I wanted to major in. I was the first one in my family to go to college. And so it was very new. I did enjoy the college life at that time. I did better than I expected because I didn't do very well in high school academically. And my parents were... Italian. They spoke both English and Italian, but they didn't speak Italian to me. I just know some expressions. And so I was raised in a bilingual house. My father only went to the third grade, so he was practically functionally illiterate. My mother only went to eighth grade. And she worked. We were very lucky because my father had failing health. He had a rheumatic heart. And he died when I was 13. But my mother had a job with Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company. And they had a satellite. They built a satellite company in my hometown of Cumberland who knows why? I mean, this is a big corporation, and I don't know why they built it, but thank God they did, because she was able to really bring us up from being poor into, you know, working class, which is a big thing, which we got our, we got because of her working there. We got an indoor bathroom, one bathroom. Remember those days? Maybe you guys don't remember those days. There was, most Americans had just one bathroom in their house. And so, and that's where I learned about stocks. My mother, I don't know, might have been through the union. There was a union in those days. She bought 3M shares that I just I inherited some of them, and I just recently sold them 2 months ago for a good price, because it's about time to sell them. I don't own individual shares anywhere else. And so, and then getting back, then I went to college for a year, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I enlisted in the Marines. Both of my older brothers were in the military. My oldest brother was a World War II vet, and my other brother, Joe, he served in peacetime in the Marines, and he was stationed out here in California. In fact, he was stationed in 29 Palms, which is, you know, 40 miles from here, and he talked about this area, the Palm Springs area, when he would come home from leave and all that stuff. And so that was ingrained in my head. Little did I know, 55 years later, I'd be retired here.
That's
great. So I went into the Marines, and I didn't want to go home. I like the climate out here in California, northern Wisconsin. It gets very cold. And so I served in Nam, and I got wounded over there after serving only 38 days.
What year did you go over there, Steve?
In 1968, the worst time.
I was going to say.
During the Tet Offensive.
Wow.
And I was hit by...
Explain what that experience was like. Were you nervous to go there? What were your thoughts as you departed?
Early on, I went in, I thought, you know, I believed the hype about, you know, we need to save South Vietnam because South Vietnam needed us and all that stuff. And ironically, in basic training, I learned that we were involved in a civil war down there. So I had doubts right there. As soon as I was in basic training in San Diego, I learned that, oh, this is not right. And so about being nervous and all that, I don't remember being nervous. My oldest brother told me, you know, they're shooting and killing people over there. And that's all he said. That's all he said. He was very much a hands-off. He wasn't, you know, about to tell me what to do. I was 20 years old, and I have to learn things on my own. And boy, did I learn. So I went over, and, you know, everybody hates basic training. I actually liked basic training in the Marines. It was, I was always a physical fitness nut, and I was really in good shape, and I was very strong. You know, I'm a farm kid. I threw bales around. I was naturally strong. So so I was shipped to Nam, and I was wounded by a mortar round. It just came out of nowhere. It wasn't in a big horrific firefight or anything like that. I was at base camp, and somebody told me to go across the base camp and get some tool we needed. I was a Amtrak driver. We needed a tool to fix our Amtrak, and there was lots of other people there. But we were in the middle of a rice paddy, and so I came back, and I thought I heard incoming. And I stood still, and I didn't hear anything. And then I walked back to where we were fixing the Amtrak. Everybody was looking out over the perimeter out in the rice paddy, and I asked somebody, what's going on? And they said a mortar round had landed outside the perimeter. And so then we just got back to work. So that mortar round was just a way of zeroing in. So the next one came in and got three of us. And I was course, I don't know how to explain it. I never lost consciousness. I knew I had to get into safety because they usually send in a bunch of them at the same time. They walk them across. And so I managed. I couldn't run because my knee got wounded. And so I crawled into a safe area, and everybody scrambled in tanks and everywhere. And I was all by myself for about, an eternity, like 10 or 15 seconds. And so finally a medic came along, and they hauled me down in this bunker. And the head medic said, "Boy, they're coming in early today." Yeah, jeez.
Wow.
And I was in shock. I was hyperventilating. I never experienced that in my life. I couldn't get enough air. Because I noticed I was hit in my left side, in my lung. It was mostly in my legs, but it was all over. And I noticed there was a wound in my chest, and I thought maybe my lung was, wounded. And so that's when I was scared. And I don't know how much you want to go on with this. Anyway, so I got medevaced out of the country because I had a knee injury, so I got out of there, and I was very lucky to survive that.
Do you feel effects today from that injury?
Oh, yeah. I can't do – it's weaker than my regular knee, and it aches once in a while. But I'm able to walk and do all the things that I taught, for 24 years. So,
well, Steve, thank you for sharing that, and thank you for the courage you showed to go over there. And boy,
I think it was stupidity more than courage.
Well, that's why they draft 20-year-olds, right?
farm kids yeah. Go in the military. You know, that's just sort of a fact of life.
Well, Steve, we appreciate your service. What was it like? And I know we're going to get to the financial stuff here in just a little bit, but you have such an interesting background here. What was it like when you came back from Vietnam?
You mean in terms of our
how were you received? How did you feel? What was the environment like?
I had never got that anything negative. From all the killing babies comments or stuff like that. I never got any of that stuff. I went back home. I was in the hospital for 4 months, and then I went back to Wisconsin, and I was warmly received back there. I went and saw some friends at River Falls where I went to college, and everybody welcomed me back. My cousin arranged a party, and she had flags all over, and had some of the family get together. So I had a good time. I didn't have that negative feedback. In Oakland, I was at the Oakland Naval Hospital. Strangers would come in all the time, every night, visitors, and some of them I went home with them. They invited me to dinner. I just never had a negative comment. Like, and I'm just shocked at what I've heard from some people that they've gotten bad comments. So that's what it was like for me.
Well, as a social studies teacher, I have to say I'm fascinated by this story. I may even get in touch with you again about that. But thanks for sharing that, Steve. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
So, Steve, it sounds like you were introduced to California. How did you become a California teacher?
It took several years. I had to find work right away. My sister lived in Norwalk, California, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And that's how I that was my introduction. I lived with her and her family for a year. And then I went to a dental technician school, one of those fast trade school training things that lasted 6 months. So I got a job as a dental technician. And I went to Cerritos College, junior college, because I wanted to continue my education. And that's what I did basically for the 5 years, 6 years that I moved out. My sister and I found a Marine friend who also got discharged. His name was Lou, and we lived together for a few years. And I always continued. I went to LACC and also worked. It was hard. I also worked as an LA Times deliverer, and I cleaned a office. I was a custodian. I did these odd jobs. And then I met Dan, and that's what changed my life. I met Dan at this. In those days, they had these psychological gurus all over the place. Every street corner had a guru, and I just I was looking for some spiritual whatever, and I found this center that I liked. And it was like the Encounter Movement in those days, and Dan was another participant. And so we hit it off right away.
And Steve, this is Dan Robertson, who you were now married to, correct?
For 40 years. That was 40 years ago. We met up in Big Bear. They had a satellite community up in Big Bear. So we met on a weekend workshop. And so... Then, and I was working full-time as a dental technician, and so I wanted to go back to school full-time. I had 2 years of college, and I wanted to finish college, and so I was able to finish college with Dan's support. Dan was my sugar daddy for a while, although I had some income myself. So I finished college, and I wanted to be a counselor. And so I did that for a couple of years, and I kept getting laid off, so I decided I wanted something more permanent and big change of job. So it was hard to find a counseling job, and somebody mentioned that LAUSD was looking for people. So I just out of curiosity, I'd never thought of being a teacher. That was not the thing to do. If you ask me why did I become a teacher, it's because I needed a job. That's why I became a teacher. And people kind of know the bureaucracy and the regulations and all that stuff, and it's the kind of environment I didn't want to really be a part of. But I needed a job. And what I liked about when I went to this presentation, it was at USC, the administrator there was talking to about 100 people there. He welcomed us. Please, we need you. And I never had that kind of a welcome. So I had a good feeling about LAUSD. They needed teachers. So I signed up for the emergency credential program at USC, and I started teaching in 1984.
Were you age 35, Steve? Is that
what I was? 36.
36, okay.
36, yeah. And then it was the first year of teaching. You know how bad it's rough.
Oh, yeah.
It's really rough. But what kept me going is that one of my instructors says it takes 3 to 5 years to become a teacher. And I kept that in the back of my head. After getting through that first year, the second year was much easier, and then I started liking it. I did not like it. I think most teachers don't like their first year because you don't know what you're doing. You really don't know what you're doing. You don't know how to manage the kids. You don't know how to. You don't. There's so much to learn. And I found learning about investments a lot easier than my first.
They generally don't talk back to you.
And then that same first year, I started my 403B. And it was, the tax sheltered annuity and getting sold a fixed annuity.
So did someone come into your school, to your classroom? How did you learn about that? And I'm guessing you never heard the term 403B?
No, that was years later. Yeah, it was just TSA that I knew about it. And I believe she was a woman, was parked in our cafeteria or somehow. I don't know. I don't remember how I met her. And Dan had been saving in his 403B at Cal State Los Angeles for a few years, so I started it, started mine. And I started with $200 a month, and which was a lot of money in those days. And so that was in like the beginning of 1985, I started with the TSA. In the back of my mind, I wondered, though, is how is this person getting compensated? But I let it go because at that time, that TSA with Great American Life Insurance Company was paying 12%. So nothing wrong with that return, even, you know. So,
and but plus, there probably wasn't too many other options at that point in time in 1985.
Well, I didn't know any of the other options. You know, I just didn't know anything at that time. You know, getting back to, you know, I knew about stocks and all that stuff. And I think Dan and I, we talked occasionally about going seeing a broker, but that turned us off. We didn't want to go see a broker. We just didn't know enough about that. I did, in the Marines, I did sign up to save for savings bonds. So I had $500 when I was discharged 2 years later. Okay, so that's how I got started, and with my 403B in 1985 with nothing. Dan and I had nothing. He started his when he was 35. Dan is 6 years older than me, so we both started with a couple of broken down. When we met, we had a couple of broken down Volkswagens, few furniture. We didn't inherit. We didn't come from wealthy families. Neither one of us. The reason why we've been together for so long, one of the main reasons, and this is what couples have problems with, is over money. We're both have a really nice balance between spending and being frugal and what is important. And you don't want to be a miser and you don't want to be a spendthrift. I mean, if one of us was a spendthrift, we wouldn't have lasted for 40 years. It just wouldn't work, you know. So we were brought up in the age of, you know, Americans used to be what we call frugal. The word wasn't used in those days. They just, I think they had common sense. They were satisfied with the one bathroom house. They were satisfied with the house that they had with the white picket fence. Nothing fancy. Those days are gone. Now people want the best, you know, and so that was the environment that both of us were raised in, and that's how we have our same philosophy about money and saving. And also, one more thing, as a gay couple in 1975, there's no support.
Sure.
There was no support for us, so we had to take care of ourselves. We don't know about pensions or anything. We couldn't rely on something or somebody else taking care of us. And that's why we both started our 403B as soon as we can.
So what we're going to do for the listeners here is we're going to do a separate podcast right after this. And we're going to bring Dan Robertson, Scott, or Steve's husband, in. And we're going to talk about the challenges of finances for same-sex couples, your experience. And we're going to really delve into your book that you two wrote together. So that is something we'll do right after this.
Okay.
And Steve, yeah. I concur with this idea of how suddenly Americans, I think, are very excessive. I've been reading a lot about Mr. Money Mustache, and I know that you've communicated with him. And I think his message of frugality and what really makes you happy is real. It certainly has resonated with me. And I wonder if there's going to be a pushback, especially after this financial crisis, to maybe being a little bit more along the ways that you were talking about, the way you grew up, having less.
I hope so. I love Mr. Money Mustache, too. I wrote a blog post about him. My favorite post, I haven't read all of his stuff, but my favorite post is where people can adapt to living on less. And it was a brilliant post. I thought that you can do it. People don't give themselves a chance to say they can live on less. You can afford that $100 a month.
I couldn't agree more. And I would love to get him on this. Well, let's do this. Let's get back into the 403B here. You start a 403B with Great American. It sounds like it was probably a fixed annuity paying about 12.5%. I think you said you started in 1985.
Right.
When did you start raising questions? What initially led you to begin to push back? And let's talk about your early 403B advocacy.
Well, this is in the 1980s. A few years later, the interest rate started coming down. It slowly went from, it didn't stay at 12% very long. It started coming down to 10, then it went down to 9, and it went all the way down to 3%. That's when I was wondering, well, what the heck is going on here? Why is it at 3%? And I kind of knew a little bit about interest rates, because interest rates in general were coming down in those days. And coincidentally, Dan and I've been learning about that fixed annuities may not be the best place for an investment. And so that was in the back of my mind. But you know what? I was teaching. I was in a PhD program at UCLA, so I didn't have a lot of time to follow up on this stuff. And it was in 1990 where I stopped putting money into Great American Life Insurance Company because I learned about the surrender fee. So I asked my agent to put me in a product that didn't have a surrender fee. Now, you know where this is going.
Continue.
Because Dan had lost his grant funding, so he was out of work there for a while. And I just wanted to be able to have access to this money in case we needed it. And so so that went on for a couple of more years. And then Dan and I, then we started learning more about mutual funds. And then I started researching on a LAUSD site. And then I was getting pushback. This is where my advocacy started. I was getting pushback from LAUSD, from the benefits people there. They didn't want to tell me anything. I had to go through this song and dance to get a list. And I write extensively about that in the book, trying to get a list from these people. That's what my antennas went up. What are these people afraid of? And so that's where the advocacy started. And this was by 1993, 1994. And so then I finally got the list. I went through their song and dance. I had to write them all down over the phone. And because they wouldn't give me a hard copy, it's against district policy to give me a hard copy.
It wasn't unbelievable. Were there hundreds of vendors?
There was 155. And then I had to go to the newspaper.
So over the phone, you wrote these all down?
Well, I wrote down, I just wanted the mutual, no-load mutual funds.
So that probably didn't take long, right?
And
about 30 seconds.
They, well, no. The clerk didn't know which ones were no-load, so I had to copy down all of the mutual funds. I had to go to the newspaper. Then I found, you know, because in those days they listed the mutual funds and they had no-loads listed there. That's how I found out. And nobody should have to go through that. That's what I was thinking. What is going on? You know, this is my money. This is not district money. You know? So it's amazing how these feelings are still there after 20 years. You know, it's not a benefit. I can understand if the district were matching, then maybe they would have some restrictions and stuff like that. But this is all my money. And so I found Invesco, and so I started putting my money in Invesco. And then within a year, I wanted to transfer my my two annuities into Invesco or Fidelity. I forget which I did. That's when I found out that the second annuity, where I thought there wasn't a surrender fee, there was a surrender fee. And that just really, sent me off on this advocacy. In my face, she didn't do what I told her to do. And I didn't know at that time I could have filed with the State Insurance Commission about that. That this is what I wanted, and this is what she gave me, another surrender fee annuity. I did. So,
do you know what the surrender charge was? Do you recall?
Yeah, it was 18. Both of them were 18%. It was horrific.
18%.
Yeah, it was 27. I got what was it? About $27,000. The non-surrender fee was the surrender cost for both was $6,000. So,
$6,000. If you were putting in the $200 a month that you're talking about, that's 30 months worth of contributions that you would have had to give up. You would have to give up in order to get
right.
out.
Yeah. So that's what started my advocacy. So this was like a 1995, 1996. And then I started communicating with the teachers union and, what else? And then I, David Tikovsky, the school board member, was also interested in knowing what's going on. And I got lucky. I happened to talk to the editor of the union newspaper who understood what I was trying to say. And so he started publishing my articles and in the UTLA newspaper, and so that was a big break. That was in 1996, and then 2 years later, Dan and I were in Makeover, in the Money Makeover, I believe it was called, and
in the LA Times.
So, and then I talked to the reporter. Said, "Who would be interested in a 403B story?" And she said she recommended Kathy Kristoff. So I called her up, and she had pen in hand, and she took my story, and that's where it really took off from there. When then I met all the people that I know now from that story. I didn't know that. I was all alone in the district, except for the editor of the newspaper and a school board member. I didn't know any other teachers until the LA Times article came out in 1998. Then I got 25 letters because they wouldn't publish my email. I got 25 handwritten letters. That's what, met Sandy Keaton and Joe McDonald and Brad and a bunch of people. I was flabbergasted. I didn't know there was anybody else. That's the problem with, if we're going to jump forward to, I'll hold off on that thought, because that's an issue that still is happening today.
Yeah, true. It is. We are not in a place of conclusion where everything is nice and tidy by any means. But I think people listening to this, maybe it'll give them more appreciation of how far we have come. And I would argue that we have so much farther to go. Before we were recording, I shared my experience with two of my students from the University of New Mexico who were recent hires, and they're in different districts near Albuquerque, and they generally have crappy choices still. And here we are in 2015. So I've had a lot of frustration about where we are today. But let's go back to about 1998, 2000. Tell us what you continue to do. I think you've made enormous inroads in 403B advocacy, but I really liked what you did around the payroll deduction. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Sandy, my friend Sandy.
This is Sandy Keaton?
Sandy Keaton, yeah. Yes. And she was wondering about that we should try and ask the district, let's change that, because they have, on the payroll stub, it says TSA. Well, the objection is obvious that the district is implicitly or explicitly announcing that, they support TSAs or only TSAs are available. So we wanted to change it to a 403B because that is the legal title of the tax deferment. And that's where UTLA helped, the teachers union. Sam Kressner was the assistant to the president at that time, and I had a relationship with him. I should have mentioned him before too. He was good, but the priorities, unions have other priorities. But he kept in touch with both Sandy and I. So he wrote a letter to the benefits, and he explained the situation that what you're doing is implicitly endorsing only TSA products. And, you know, that you have custodial accounts for mutual fund companies, too. And, of course, the district responded immediately, okay, we'll change it.
Really?
They changed it right away.
Oh, I didn't know that part of the story. I would have figured there had been pushback because of, I don't know, ink costs or something.
When you bring up liability.
Ooh, yes.
Liability, you know, because they always back off of recommending or saying anything. Remember, I couldn't get a list from them because they view that as a recommendation. So they changed that right away. Yeah, that was... And at the same time, UTLA, Sandy and I sent a proposal to have a workshop, a 403B workshop at UTLA in Palm Springs, because every year they have a leadership conference. It's not for all members. It's just for leadership. What we call the unions, private sector calls union stewards, call them chapter chairs. Every school of the 700 schools in LA Unified as a chapter chair. And so there's a conference every year. And Sandy and I thought that would be a good time to have a workshop on this 403B, because we have a message. Sandy and I had been meeting informally at this restaurant. That's where I met you, Scotty. You showed up at one of our meetings.
Yeah.
Starting right after the LA Times article, Sandy and I decided to, let's meet at this restaurant, which is centrally located up in the valley. And at that time, I had about 100 people on my email list. And every month we met like every other month. We couldn't meet every month. We would get anywhere from 5 to 12 people. LAUSD employees would come in. And out of that, Scotty came in, and some of the TI Crep people came in, and Carolyn Widener from the CalSTRS board, she liked what we were doing, and that was a huge boost for us. So where am I going with this? So we wanted to have a workshop because, people weren't getting our message. So let's try a workshop at the leadership conference. And they accepted our workshop. It was in August of 2000. And I shared this in our book that I couldn't attend that workshop because I was just told by my doctor that I had colon cancer. So that weekend.
Wow.
So I was in no mood to go and give that workshop. But Sandy and Brad and Joel did a terrific job. They covered, because it was a panel of us. It wasn't just me or Sandy. It was a panel anyway. So they buried your mom too.
Did you get any pushback from anyone at that time? Any unions, any financial firms as you began to really kind of ramp up your advocacy in 2000?
Yeah, there was a little bit of pushback at that time. It was Steve, the editor's name. He said to me, I asked him, as a matter of fact, why didn't my last article go in? And he said, well, some of the vendors are complaining that they don't get enough. They don't get their share. They don't have a voice in this. And I said to him, well, yeah, because I'm a member of this union, and they're not. They're not members. And so I guess he was satisfied with that answer, and he just walked away. And my articles began reappearing. Later on, the big pushback was when the LA Times ad came out that celebrated, you know, the AB 2506, which was state legislation to change the the insurance code. I don't know how much you want to get into
that. I'll just jump in and say that. That was explained. That was 2002. In the state of California, if a school district wants to put their 403B plan out to bid and select one vendor or two vendors based on things like fees and services, it's actually illegal. And we've had two unsuccessful efforts to change this, and we have been fought by the financial services industry and, surprisingly, in some cases, unions who don't want to change the status quo. So 2002 is when this whole movement really kind of came together, myself, Scott, you, others, around this legislation. What was your involvement with that, Steve?
Well, I testified in the first hearing, and that was about it. I testified as a teacher representing UTLA, and also the UTLA lobbyist, Bill, was there, supportive of this measure. So it wasn't until later when TI Cref wanted to do a celebration ad. They put this ad in the paper with my picture on it in the LA Times. And it was a big ad. And UTLA got about 50 phone calls. The treasurer got 50 phone calls. And so another officer called me at home, and he said that the treasurer, I'm not going to mention any names, we all know each other, was livid at the ad, and he was threatening to sue TIA Cref. And I said, what for? And he said, for using their name. And I said, well, UTLA supported this legislation. Anyway, long story short, nothing happened, but this treasurer never trusted me again. And luckily for all of us, he was defeated in the next election. And so he was booted out, and we got a treasurer that did understand, David Goldberg, who did understand us and did a lot of good for our cause.
Steve, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, Steve. Let's take a step back real quick. So this legislation that you testified for, real quickly, was originally designed to allow school districts to have, instead of having the 155 vendors, you know, essentially allowing anybody who wants to offer a product, it was supposed to allow a school district to control their 403B plan and actually take it out to bid, a competitive bid, and that legislation got defeated, but the bill was reworked and passed. The bill number was AB 2506. It was actually passed as a disclosure database. So this was at kind of the beginning of the internet, and the bill that you lobbied for and UTLA lobbied for and what TIA Cref was celebrating was this bill that essentially required anybody who offered a 403B in California had to register with this database, which eventually came to be known as 403bcompare.com. It's still in existence today. And they had to disclose their products, their fees, and whatnot. And so this was really ahead of its time. Federal legislation that was similar to this, or excuse me, federal regulations that were similar to this, didn't happen for over another decade. So here in California, we kind of looked at that bill as almost a defeat, but we were way ahead of the game there. And just getting that disclosure in a place where teachers could, for the first time, get online and compare their different 403B plans was really a major victory. A small victory in what hopefully will be some major victories along the way. But, you know, you were a big part of that, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody knows what legislation we were talking about.
And Scott, thanks again for mentioning 403B Compare, because again, you don't have to be a California teacher to access this. I share this link almost on a daily basis to teachers from all over the country. So this, I think, is a huge arrow in our quiver. And Steve, you played a huge role in that.
Yeah, we definitely wanted the disclosure and to reduce the number of vendors and have more accessibility so that teachers don't have to go through what I went through to try to find out what's on the so-called list. And
so we're at about 50 minutes here, and like I said, we'll do a second podcast with your partner and husband Dan Robertson here in a moment. Could you talk about what is on your plate right now? What are you still really concerned about? Where are we at on 403B advocacy? Also, I just got a question via Twitter, which I will ask you at the end.
Well, as you know, I've been a member of lots have happened with LAUSD, and I can't thank George Tischler, a benefits administrator, that launched the 457B. That was a major breakthrough. This was in 2006, and his colleague, David Holmquist, who is now the general counsel, legal counsel for the district, asked me to be a member of this committee. And I didn't really know very much. I didn't know very much about the 457B and also being a member of the committee. And so that's been my involvement. Sandy and I don't do those restaurant workshops anymore because there wasn't any time. We were involved. Both of us were on this committee. So that's been going on. It's been a struggle with, again, disclosure. It doesn't matter what kind of plan you have. The industry is going to fight disclosure, even in the 457B plan. And I don't know if George anticipated this, but the committee, I am so proud of our committee. And because there were some people that came in from who I knew from before.
I'm going to ask Scott, why don't you jump in and explain briefly what a 457 is and then why it was such a good development for LA Unified to have a 457.
Sure. That's a bit of a long story. I'll try to make it pretty short, though. 457 is very similar to a 403B. It's only allowed, so the 457B is only allowed for government plans. Typically, we'll see it in the public sector, police, fire, that kind of an area. It's been available to teachers or educators for a long time. However, it used to be coordinated with the 403B. So essentially, if you made contributions to one or the other, they were aggregated. So if your contribution limit was $8,000, that was a total you can make to both plans. With, I think it was EGTRA in 2001, that allowed the 457 to be actually a separate plan, meaning you had separate contribution limits for the 403B and the 457. You could contribute to both without them affecting each other. And so effectively, teachers gained access to a whole other retirement plan and a whole other contribution limit. The significance here is in California, and in many states, California, we have all these laws on the books for the 403B, specifically this one, this any willing vendor law. So any company that wants to offer its products for the 403B, they got to offer them. The school district, for the most part, has to offer them. 457, there are no laws on the books for that. In fact, the laws on the books for 457 are all fiduciary-based, at least here in California. There is a fiduciary responsibility by the employer. Now, again, most employers in California don't take that responsibility seriously in the education market. They do in the other markets. But so this presented an opportunity, as Steve is saying, for LAUSD and for the folks listening who are outside of California, that's the Los Angeles Unified School District, presented an opportunity for them to have a single vendor program, an actual plan that's just one vendor that they can use instead of or in addition to the 403B. And so the school district could get behind this one plan and promote it and without the fear of having to add other vendors to it. So it kind of created this shift in the ability of school districts to control their retirement plans, at least in some respect.
Okay, very well explained. And we've talked in the past about, you know, teachers stuck with bad plans. Maybe they look at a Roth IRA, which they can open up with any vendor. But also another solution is ditch the 403B and do a 457. What I'd like to do is we've got three more questions. Steve, what would you tell an advocate out there? Let's say there's a young teacher in, pick a state, we'll just say Wisconsin because that's where you were. Actually, Wisconsin has a good plan thanks to the
right.
union. So let's shift that. I don't know. Pick a state. Ohio, let's say.
How about California?
Well, we've got you still, Steve. You might live in Palm Springs, but I don't think you're retired, which ties into my next question, which I got from Twitter. But what would you tell an advocate out there, wherever they're based, what kind of advice would you give them to making inroads and improving 403B options for their fellow employees?
Well, first of all, learn about investing and know what a good plan is and that costs matter. And you're going to have to do some homework and have to read up on this, read a couple of books, any book by John Bogle. And your book, Teach and Retire Rich, which is specifically towards educators. And then reaching out to people. I was lucky, you know. I reached out to my unions. If you have a teacher's union and an editor, talk to the editor. See if you can write up an article. And so that's why you need to know what you're talking about and practice what you're doing. When I wrote those articles in for the union, I actually did what I was writing about. And then talk to your local newspaper reporter. Most newspapers have a financial reporter. I'm just telling people what I did, this is the hardest part, is connecting with other colleagues. Now, if you're in a small school district, that shouldn't be very hard. I think, this is my belief, every school in the country has a teacher in there that knows what we're talking about and has a good plan. Try and find that teacher in your own school and team up with that teacher. And so, because it takes more than one.
I think that's some great advice. I think there's power in collaboration. Scott has talked about being really respectful to the benefits officials. They have a lot on their table. I think there's an expression, you get more, what is it, more bees with honey. So try that approach. So here's a question I just got on Twitter. It's from Teacher Ed Mills. And I don't know if either of you know.
Yeah.
He has a fascinating story, and we're definitely going to be interviewing him.
Yeah. Yes, I heard his podcast.
He is fantastic. He's a teacher that has moved around the South, I think mostly Georgia, in pursuit of better 403B plans. And so we will interview him. But he asked this question. He said, what motivates you, Steve, to continue your advocacy?
It's not easy. there have been times I wanted to quit the committee at LUSD. I was very frustrated. And because if you're expecting to be on a stage and people applauding you, that isn't going to happen. You're going to be alone. Anybody out there that is a potential advocate, don't expect a lot of feedback. I don't know what it is about our profession. Outside of the classroom, we don't talk to each other very much. And it's mysterious, and it's probably about financial matters, and people don't like to talk about personal finance, but you have to. And it is a policy. 403B and personal finance is a policy. Talk about it as a policy that our teachers across the country are getting ripped off by annuities and commissions, never paid commissions. I mean, that's a pretty simple message.
Well, I, for one, I'm sure Scott concurs. We thank you for your continued advocacy. We hope you remain in this arena. We need you. We need you, Steve. So, again, I want to say thank you for all you've done and all that you're going to continue to do. Let's do this. Scott and I do this little thing called three questions. We're going to reduce it down to one question, and then we will go ahead and record a second interview with you and your partner, Dan. So, Scott, do you have a question prepared for Steve and I?
I do. It's a little on the boring end, but I'm actually interested in the outcome of this question just because I know how I do this. And how others in my family do it. So physical book or ebook? So Kindle, Apple ebooks or physical? Do you prefer having a physical book in your hands and reading it, or would you be more comfortable on a Kindle e-reader, something like that?
We'll have our guests go first. Steve, why don't you answer that first?
Well, I guess it depends on the book. I have both. I still like a paperback because I can make marks in it and all that stuff. And I'm learning to do that in the Kindle version, in the electronic version, to make marks, because that's so important. To make marks and ask questions, and so I like them both. As far as an author, I think it's more of an advantage to have an electronic version, because and we'll talk about this when Dan comes on. People have downloaded from Amazon 11,000 electronic books in the free version. This is for free. And so I think that's great. That's great. And you couldn't do that. We couldn't do that with a paperback because we couldn't give it away without, we could give it away, but it cost us a fortune. So that's the advantage of an electronic, from an author perspective. I think electronic has an advantage.
Well, I'll speak from, and I concur with that about the, from the author's perspective. I have to physically mail each book. I often get bulk orders, so I'll send out 100. But we are in the process of, we'll probably have a full electronic version in the next year of Teach and Retire Rich. Because when I'm on vacation, I have to come home and ship books and apologize for their tardy arrival. But as far as a reader, this is a great question, Scott, because I wrestled with this the other night. I had every intention of pulling out a physical book. I'm reading B.J. Novak's book. He's a writer and a performer from The Office, just hysterical short stories. This is really a fixable problem, but I don't have a great nightlight, a great reading light at my bed. I have to turn all the lights on, and I don't love having a bedroom completely lit up. So I ended up just grabbing my iPad, which sits on my nightstand, and I ended up surfing web pages. So I think I just default to the easier, and that's the electronic book. But if you were to say between Audible and electronic, I think I like Audible books better.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Dan. I get through about 4 books a month on Audible, whereas an actual physical book, whether it's a physical book or on an ebook, it could take me months.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, I have a question now. And Steve, we kind of gave you a late email about this. If you have a question, you can ask it too. If you don't, no worries. But here's my question. It is, okay, which president do you prefer? President Whitmore from Independence Day. Remember, he was a kick-ass fighter pilot, I think. Or President Bartlett from The West Wing. Steve, go first.
What was the question?
Okay. You sound like one of my students. What the hell is he talking about? Okay. Favorite president between these two. President Whitmore, who was the president on the movie Independence Day. And there's a reason I asked this question. I'll explain it in a moment. Or President Bartlett, who was the president on West Wing.
Well, I liked both West Wing and the movie, and I'm trying to think back of the characters of the two. And
well, one basically saved the world. Okay, the other I think got some healthcare policy through.
I couldn't answer the question. Okay. I don't know that.
Okay, Scott,
I got an answer. Definitely President Bartlett. West Wing was one of my favorite shows. I'll watch anything by Aaron Sorkin, but Bartlett was such an inspirational character. And The West Wing is such a great... what I love about The West Wing, real quick, is how they all worked together as this team, and it just looked like it was... You know, they had ups and downs, and it kind of reminds me of us. I mean, we don't all get together and walk down corridors speaking at, 1,000 words a second. But, we all work together as a team to get stuff done. And there are, as Steve said, there are some definitely some tough times, and you feel like quitting so much. And then something happens, and you decide, you know what, I can't quit this. I got to keep doing it. And you go on. And if it wasn't for, you know, people like Dan Otter and Dan Robinson, Steve Shulo and Sandy Keaton, and all these great people, you know, I wouldn't continue to do this. I don't think I'd be able to. So that's what West Wing inspires me in that way. So I'm going with Bartlett.
Well said. And I guess that makes Steve Shulo our President Bartlett. Well, the reason I asked this question is they are currently filming Independence Day 2 in Albuquerque.
Oh.
And I just found out that one street over, Jeff Goldblum is renting a house while he's here to film. A neighbor friend rode on an airplane with him from L.A. To Albuquerque. So we got that scoop. Some of the kids in the neighborhood have been going up to the door, knocking on the door, but I've heard no reports of Mr. Goldblum answering. All right, well, this has been really good. Let's go ahead and end this section, and then we'll pick up in a little bit and ask about your book and your relationship with Dan and all kinds of investing things about your investing life. So thanks again, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.